Good evening, everyone. Are these on? Is it all here? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE for this evening's event. My name is Carmela Shamsi. I'm a novelist, but more to the point, I'm here as a fan tonight, I think. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome Riyad Sathouf to the LSE today. Riyad is a best-selling cartoonist and filmmaker who grew up in Syria and Libya and now lives in Paris. He's the author of four comic strips in France and a former contributor to the satirical publication Charlie Hebdo. He's now a weekly columnist for L'Obs, which I'm probably mispronouncing.
No, perfect. No,
fine. He also directed the films The French Kissers and Jackie in the Women's Kingdom. The Arab of the Future, which was awarded the Favre d'Or Prize for the Best Album of the Year, has been translated into 16 languages and is his first work to appear in English. I should say this is the second book. It's going to be a series which we will have to wait for, but at least there are two of them out already. The Arab of the Future tells the unforgettable story of his childhood spent in the shadows of three dictators, Gaddafi, Hafez al-Assad, and his father, revealing the inner workings of a tormented country and a tormented family, taking in the sweep of Middle Eastern politics in the 1980s, the ascendancy of religion, and the persistence of poverty. For those Twitter users in the audience today, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Sathouf, over there, if you want to know how you should be spelling that. Please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The evening's proceedings are being recorded and will hopefully be available as a podcast soon, subject to no technical difficulties, whatever that might mean. So the format of today's evening event is going to be in conversation. Riyad and I will speak for about 40 or 45 minutes, and then I'll open up the floor to questions. After that, there are books being sold outside, and if you want Riyad to sign them, which I'm sure you will, he'll be on stage signing them. Well, to start with, just the question, why decide to write a memoir, and why in so many parts?
I had the idea of telling this, those years in the Middle East for many years,
yeah.
But I think a part of me didn't want it to be immediately the guy with Arab origin who tells story from his origin. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I've made a lot of comics in France before of that.
Mm-hmm.
I made movies that are absolutely not about Syria. Or something like that. And then in 2011, I had to help a part of my family who was still living in Homs to leave the country because the civil war was beginning. And I had a lot of difficulties to obtain them authorization in France.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to tell in comics how hard it was. But to tell this story, I had to tell the whole story from the beginning. So I started saying to myself, it's time to make this series. And especially there is another reason, because I've made one movie in France, my first movie, called The French Kissers, but didn't went out in England.
Yeah.
But in France it was a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
And after that was able to do another movie, so everybody gave me much more money, budget and everything. And it was an incredible failure,
when
it goes.
Right.
So after that, I had no more friends, and I decided to center on my comics and to tell the story I had in mind for many years. And this is how it began.
I'm interested in the form as much as I am in it, anything else. And I wonder for you, because of course you've been working on comics for years, but did this feel sort of just like an extension of the kind of work you were already doing? Or is doing a graphic memoir, does it feel like a profoundly different way of working?
No, it's quite difficult because as a reader or as a spectator, I don't really like autobiographical stories, especially in comic fields. Because when you, it happened to me, I won't say names, but when I meet people, authors of autobiographical, they always look like, how to say, they draw themselves too gently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they're beautiful, and you see them in real life, and like, hello, and say, man, are you really drawing yourself? And I was afraid of doing the same for me, you know, like, and I was seeking for a good way to tell this story. And then I remembered that when I was very young, I was extremely beautiful, you know? So it solved everything, you know. I was blonde with the big hair, you know. All the women wanted to touch my hair every time. It was, you know, this is what I say, but I, the first part of my life, I was an elf, you know, like.
Yeah.
And at the adolescence, my hair became as there today, and I became like, you know, a troll or a orc. And I'm, you know, I'm a troll with the memory of an elf, you know. I live in my forest. I know what it is to be beautiful. And I will tell this in the book because it changed your perception of reality, I think. So,
well, that's a line in one of the books. Yeah. I'm a troll with the memory of an elf.
Exactly. This is a
but, you know, I mean, so when the first book covers the years 1978 to 1984, which is the first 6 years of your life, the next one is 1984 to 1985. Of course, it's a memoir, and one of the first questions it's going to raise is to do with memory, particularly the memory of a very young child. And there are, I mean, there are things in it that just seem so powerful in terms of visual memory that I, you know, have to believe that they've always been there. But I wondered how, you know, how much of this is actual visual memory you have, how much is sort of secondhand from, say, your mother or a relative, and how much is maybe from looking at, I don't know, images online or elsewhere?
No. It's all the story is from my own memory. Mm. I recreated some scenes. I recreated the dialogues.
Okay.
For example, I don't remember precisely what my father was saying, but each scene is a visual memory, at least. You know, but I have very, very vivid memories of that time. It's like a memory from an animal, you know. I don't know. It's like, I remember smell, sounds, colors, ambience. I don't know. It's like a country where I can get back. I can go back.
Yeah.
So it's much more complicated to not tell everything than I have to choose what I tell. Ah, this time. And there is a lot of memories I didn't tell.
You say it's like a country that you go back to. Have you been back specifically to, with these first two books, the places you write about in Libya and Syria within these books?
If I
have you been back
in real life? No, never. No.
Okay, so this is very much.
No, I prefer to be a comic artist in Paris.
Fair enough.
It's much more cool.
You mentioned ambience, and there are three different locations. There's France, there's Syria, there's Libya. And each one is with a different sort of color wash. So there's blue is France, yellow is Libya, there's sort of red for Syria. And it's a very effective way of creating a sense of movement for the readers, because you're suddenly, you know, you're sort of become, you almost forget you're looking at something that is with a blue wash until suddenly you turn the page and there's a yellow wash and you feel somewhere very different. But I wonder if you could talk, because you mentioned ambience, what do each of those colors evoke for you?
I was seeking a graphic way to express, I don't know the word in English to express this, but it's dépaysement in French. It's like maybe somebody speaks French and
you can
English
translate.
Dépaysement, I don't know what the...
Anyone?
It's when you are used to a place, and then after that you're in another place.
Yeah, like dislocation?
Dislocation, yeah. Maybe. And I realized that in my memory, Libya was very shiny and yellow, and Syria was red because of the soil on the ground. It was red, you know, like in Brazil, very, very red. So, and France, it was blue, because I lived in Brittany, and I decided to make how to say, contrainte. You know, you have to unpeach yourself, to have too much power to concentrate. Mm-hmm. So one color by one country. Mm. And this is exactly to provoke what you said before, that when you're used to an ambience and a country and you read it's yellow and then bang, it's blue, and you have to adapt to another feeling, another. It was very close to what I experienced when I was young, I think.
And did you have that even, because there are points where you'll for a summer go to France from. So that early experience of moving around mean that after a while it just seems natural, or did you continue to have that sense of dislocation every time there was a movement?
At that time, yes, when I was young, really, it was very clear, because I was preferring, can we say that?
Yeah.
I was preferring France, because there was, big stores and toys and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in Syria, it was much more rough, and I had to fight. I don't know how to say. No, it's. I was not only beautiful. I had to prove to my cousin that I was a man. You know, but at that time, if somebody look at me and say "wah," I would starting to cry. You know, like all the boys, they were having fight all day, and so it was much more complicated.
There's a point very early on when you say as a, 3-year-old or something, that Gaddafi reminded me of me, as in Gaddafi was like a child. But there's sort of one of the interesting things to me that these figures of these dictators are, they're in the background, but they're very present, which is, the way of a dictatorship really is, even if they're in the background, they're always pregnant. Present, but there is that aspect that in the way that a child feels that the whole world is about him or her and gets, expects and demands attention, and a dictatorship is much like that. But there's another way of looking at it. You sometimes hear this notion, which can sound very old-fashioned, that the leader of a state is like the father of the nation. Because your father is a very powerful figure a very strong figure in here, and a complicated one. What do you think of the notion that men, or perhaps we can speak specifically about your father, or you can talk more generally about the uncles as well, that in some ways they look to these dictators who run the countries and found their a way in which to be a man that they thought seemed something they might want to emulate in the family?
I don't know if it's hard to explain it like that. For example, in Syria, we were living in a small village near Homs, and in this village there was no portrait of Assad, for example, because it was a Sunni village, and I don't know why, maybe they didn't want to provoke something or... Mm-hmm. There was no Assad picture, but when you went to Homs, he was everywhere. And my experience of Syria is that I don't remember, as a child living in this village, I don't remember cops or military. Mm. There is much more cops in Paris, for example, than at that time, And it was, I don't know how to say, it's from my point of view, it was a very everybody was complice. How can we say that? Nobody know complice in. It's when you.
No.
I don't know. It's for example,
we're sure there are people here who know, and they're just being shy.
Yeah,
and not,
shy,
not working as translators.
But for example,
someone here could really help us out.
Complicit.
When you make a crime, when you are...
Thank you. Right.
Thank you.
You are now our translator for the rest of the evening.
For example, if I remember one time, we were in a cab with my father, and the guy, the cab trespassed something, I don't know, and a cop told him, come, put yourself here. So the car stopped. And the cop came and said, hey, you trespassed the line, huh? What are you? And the guy said, oh, sorry, I'm a cab, I'm with the guy. So, no, not sorry, you trespassed. Give me $5 and I let you go. And the guy said, $5? I don't have $5. Okay, $2. And I let you go. And the guy said, no, I don't, I'm a cab. I only have Syrian pounds. You know, do you, I have five. Okay, five. Okay, have a nice day, brother. And it was like that. Everything, no direct violence in this village. And in that was mine. So I think it's difficult to say that it's a dictator were an example for, I don't know. But it's true that in my family, men were leading and women were obeying.
Yeah. I suppose one thing that comes through in the book is your father's admiration for these strong men.
Yeah.
You said that.
Yeah. My father was from a very poor background. Mm. He was the only guy from his whole family to know how to write and to read. Mm. All his 10 brothers didn't knew, never went to school. And he was very good at school, and he succeeded and became a doctor at La Sorbonne. So, like a lot of people like that from very modest origin who become somebody, he had the feeling that he had a destiny, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was a chosen one from paranormal forces and to maybe to be... Mm-hmm. And he was obsessed with politics, and he wanted to make a coup, for example, and to execute people. He was, but he was very serious. It was not for fun. And when he was, I remember when he was in France looking at TV, he said, "Yeah." When the French politician were speaking on TV, he said, "Oh, I will execute all of them. Mm. Look at them. Yeah. They're so bad. This one, he's gay. Kill him." Yeah. This part of him was all together with the other part, who he was for education, and he wanted to escape religion and bigotry and everything. But it was not so clear in his mind.
Because at the start of the first book, it starts before you're born, because it starts with your...
I have memory from that.
he remembers very well when his parents first met. It's called genetic memory. But it starts with your parents meeting in France. Your mother is French. You know, just in those first sort of very quickly, in sort of 2 or 3 pages, you show us your father, who starts off as someone who does at that point seem to have huge admiration for France, but very quickly, you know, starts to feel that he's not appreciated. Did he feel that there was bigotry towards him? There's some sense in the beginning.
No, I don't. He had, he had strong complex, for example, because he was, it was complicated because for guys from his generation, he was extremely nationalist.
Yeah.
And he was extremely, he felt extremely humiliated by the wars against Israel that were lost. Mm-hmm. And when he was in France, he was thinking that everybody looked at him as a loser, for example. He wanted to show to other people that he was brilliant and intellectually powerful. And he was, in competition with everybody, every time, everyone. He was, when he saw a strong man, he was telling me, "I'm sure I can kick his ass." You know, "I'm sure. Look at him. He thinks he's fit." And when a guy, a French doctor, was at TV, he said, "He's a Jew. It's not a true diploma he has. Jew give them together like that. They're friends." He was completely obsessed with his position and the other person's position.
Of course, the other person then who's very interesting is your mother in here. Because when they meet he's in France and he's applying for jobs to Oxford and other places, and then he, on a couple of occasions, basically announces to her, "Now we're going to Libya, now we're going to Syria." And she's relatively silent in these books. I mean, he seems to be producing a lot more noise than her. And I wondered whether, was she really that silent, or do you remember him more clearly?
No, she was really like that, like I tell in the story, because My mother was French, from a middle class family, and she was like I don't know 1940 women. She has to follow her husband and to raise her children, and she was like my father, quite obsessed with money. So my father wanted to become very rich, and she was waiting him to become very rich. So he was always telling her, "In next year, I'll make my first $1 million." That's true. And we were living in the village with, you know, people living in garbage. It was incredible. But my mother believed him because it could have. He was brilliant, and it could have happened. I don't know. It's. But her role will evaluate in the rest of the volume. And when I don't know if some of you read the first volume, but in the first volume, so we are living in Libya, then in the small village in Syria, and I describe things as they were at that time. And when my mother read the book, the first one, she read it and she told me, who do you think this will... Nobody will be interested in this. And I said, oh, really? Why? Those are the good years. At that time, we were very happy. For her, the good part of the story is what will happen next.
Right.
She was a very, how do we say in English, submissive? Sumi?
Well, let's talk about you. Let's talk about you as an artist. Because one of the first... Within the book, the first time you're ever better than your father at something is when you draw.
Yes. Battled?
When you do something better than him.
Yeah.
Because he draws a car and you draw a car and yours, you know, you're, what, 5 and your car is so much better than his.
I was not 5. I was 2.5.
And
I remember perfectly this... I remember perfectly his drawing because, like every children, like my boy, he come to me and said, "Daddy, do you draw me a car?
Yeah.
Draw me na na na." And he's 2.5, and I draw him a very good car. I asked my father to draw me a car. I remember, and he told me, "This is one of the first words I learned also in the car field." He told me, "I will draw you the best car in the world. It's a German car. It's Mercedes." And he was dreaming to have a Mercedes. So he started drawing the car, and the wheels were square, you know, like that. And it was extremely clear at my age of 2 that a car couldn't move with the car. And I told him, "Look at what? No, it's like..." And I draw a car with round wheels. And he became quite angry. He said, "You want to teach me how to draw a Mercedes? I love Mercedes. They are like that." And each time I see an old Mercedes, you know, I say, "Where he gets the wheels where it was square? I can't find. I don't know." So yes, I was better than him at 2 years old. So that's...
How did he feel about that? Do you think
he was
not
happy? No, he was not happy.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, he told me that I have to draw the wheels like he was drawing.
Yeah. There's a very moving scene later. I mean, I'm not going to give away the whole thing because people want, but there's a very moving scene which becomes even more moving in retrospect when you're with someone who describes the first artistic genius you've ever met, which is your cousin.
Yeah, one of my cousins. Yeah, she was a girl, the daughter of one of my aunt, and she was the first woman to teach me how to draw. And she gave me 2 tips that I still use today. For example, I was always drawing, you know, football fields. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was drawing a square like that and the goal like that and the line and the... And she told me, "Oh no, you can't do. Imagine that it's going from in the center of the page.
Mm-hmm.
So you put the line like that, and it's like you're seeing it really." And it was a revelation, you know.
Yeah.
This is very important. It's perspective.
Mm-hmm. And were the first Because you mentioned at some point reading these Tintin comics. Were they the first comics you remember?
Yes. It's the only books I've read, I think, from 2 to 10 years old.
Mm.
I don't know if it's famous in England.
Tintin in Milou. There's a point when you start looking at them, you don't yet read. And there's a point when you learn to read and suddenly these comics are completely different because you can read the words there as well. And I wondered what your relationship is, because with, you know, people always talk about the drawing part of your work. But of course they're the words as well. And you know, as you said with the Tintin comics, the words will completely alter it. And I wonder what your relationship is to words as opposed to the image. Does it sort of work together that you think of the image and the words, or is one secondary? I mean, do you have a...
Yeah, when I write my comics, I write and draw all together at one time.
Hmm.
It's like I put lines like with the small panels and very quickly, and it's like drawings are words.
Mm.
You know, I use them. So it's not separated between drawing and word, and this is what is quite difficult in cinema writing, because you can make movie in many ways, but I had to make scripts, and it's very difficult to use only words.
Yeah, I know.
Comics is better than literature.
You think? Yeah.
It's more powerful, you know. You have image and.
I'm sure. Well, you know, yeah, that'll be the next subject.
The next
conversation
chapter?
When I'll have prepared for it a bit better. When you talked earlier about how all the memories were, you know, you had these very strong memories. But I wondered, as you were working on the books, did memories come up that you'd forgotten were there? I mean, were there any surprises for you in remembering the sequence of events, or was it all?
Really, it happened. I don't believe in paranormal things, you know. But one day, during the first volume, I was drawing the house of my grandmother, a house where I didn't went for 20 years, I think. And it was late at night, you know, there was rain outside, like that, I was drawing. And at one point, I smelled the... The smell of her house. It appeared like a... It was incredible. It was like olfactive hallucination. So I have one of my cousin who is a neurosurgeonist. And I told him, oh, you know what happened to me? I was drawing and I had an hallucination of the smell of the house of our grandmother. And he told me, really, Ria? I said, yes, it might be a symptom of Alzheimer. And I was, no, I'm a genius. Don't tell me. And then after that, I don't go so far in my memory because I don't want to have Alzheimer.
What was the smell of your grandmother's house?
It was, you know, like smoke and dust and, how to say, very, very, very old house from... You know, I don't know, wood eaten by bees for regeneration and generation, and oh, I smell it here.
Did you feel any sense of nostalgia?
Not really. No. No, I feel nostalgia about my hair.
Okay.
This is, I must admit.
The blonde.
Yeah, the blonde, okay. And now, you know, I'm having.
I want to defend dark hair, really. It's fine.
But your hair is nice.
Yeah,
look at mine, you know. Uh-huh. It's like...
This is the conversation you knew you were coming for, right? Comparative hair conversation.
And now it's, you know, I'm going to be 40.
Yeah.
And next time I was in the shop, and there was a camera surveillance, you know. And I remember myself... When I look, I think I'm still blonde and beautiful, you know.
Okay.
And I went to the shop and I saw myself from backward, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like an old man here, you know. I don't have much more hair.
Right.
And it was completely. And I had nostalgia at that time. I said, "My God, time has passed so fast." And But the nostalgia of the country or my family, and absolutely not. No, no.
Not even for landscapes and...
No. Things like that. No, no. No, no, really. It's, I love to travel. I love to discover new places. And I'm trying to convince my wife to live in another country. I wanted to live in Netherlands and the United States, and she doesn't want. But I have no particular attachment to places and stuff like that.
Not even France?
Maybe France, because this is the best language I speak, is French. So if I go to Netherlands, I will have to learn another language, but it's not impossible at all.
I mean, it's interesting because there are people who feel, and I think it's sort of interesting with people who've moved around in their childhood a lot, and there'll be some who sort of always have a hankering for that first place, and it becomes almost like a mythic sense. And there are others, I think, who have a sense that actually, you know, human beings move.
Yeah, yeah.
And you seem very much to be of the second category.
Yeah, yeah. But it's true that when I was living in this small village in Syria, I had very strong blonde hair, and I was I stopped with the hair, but you will understand after. Yeah. And my mother was French, and we were the only foreign origin people in the village. Yeah. So when I worked in the village, I was the only guy. Everybody was looking at me like that because I had French clothes and things like that. So people, my cousin, were not considering me as their equal, for example. I had to prove I was Syrian. I had to prove I was I was not a Jew, because they were obsessed with Jew. You know, they were always telling me, you're a Jew, your mother is a Jew, all the time. So that was like that. So I hadn't the proudness of being Syrian, you know, from Syrian origin and things like that. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to France, it was a little bit the same, because my name is ridiculous in French, for example. And when I was in class, when they say my name, everybody was laughing. You know, I don't know if you speak French, but Satouf means...
Now we discover how many French speakers there are. Right.
It's a funny name. You know, it spends, can be her vagina, if you want. And nobody, you know, it's... So I was not proud of being French also, because my name was not like the other name. So I don't have proudness of origin, you know. I think it's quite ridiculous. Yeah.
Your mother had an interesting position in Syria, because it was... The rules that applied to women didn't seem to apply to her. Did she feel very isolated, do you think?
Yeah, but she was very isolated.
Did she speak Arabic at all?
No, never. She was spending her whole days on her bed, lying like that. And she booked big puzzles and making puzzles all day. Mm-hmm. She didn't speak Arabic. I think she was quite depressed, but...
Why do you think she didn't learn Arabic?
No interest, really. It was, for example, she. When we were going to Syria, she was buying books to bring back to Syria, and for years, the books were still under a blister. You know, she never read what she. And it's still a mystery. And when I speak with her today, she's for her it's still a mystery also. She said, I don't know what I've made all those years. Mm. So it's strange, yeah.
Yeah. And of course the second book ends, I'm not going to say on what, but a fairly dramatic moment, I mean an awful moment in some way where...
speak about it.
Yeah, but I'm not going to say what it is, but it's sort of interesting because your mother sort of comes more prominent there, or her sort of... views of things become more prominent. So I'm assuming in the next books we're going to see more of her. And
because
this is one of the odd things, is because this book only covers the first 7 years of Riyad's life. Essentially, I have to talk to him about the first 7 years of his life, because anything else is a spoiler for the books ahead, which is a curious sort of way to interview someone.
No, that's true. But I think in Syria. I don't like to speak generally, but in Syria there was a different way of living that were living very next door to, for example, the village that we where we were living. People were living like with small electricity every day and small water, like, I don't know, 18th century. You know, it's what was in a very, very primitive peasant way of life. And in the city just 7 kilometers from their homes, there was there were Christians that were living in buildings like in suburbs. Here. They were living in a completely different way. And so we experienced only the life of the majority of the population that were living in village, poor village. And my mother was waiting to change her social class. That's it. And soon the time passes, she realized that it was not really happening.
There's some wonderful encounters in the book as well with the with a relative who's a general and his wife, and you know, this sort of world of power that both your parents, in certain ways, they're parts of it that they aspire to.
It's very hard to, I don't know if it's easy to conceive, but for example, my family, the Satou family, actually in France, maybe there is four or five Satouf, you know. But in the village where we were living, it was like, you know, the mothership of the Satouf. And everybody was Satouf everywhere. It was, my family was a very big family, 800 people. But everybody had to take care a little about the other. You know, you knew that you were cousin with that guy, and that guy is your half cousin. And there was so a strange situation, like I had one of the cousin of my father who was a general in the army, and he had a big Mercedes, and he was living in a huge house. And in the center of the village, there was Satouf who were like homeless, you know, living in the street, and they were relative. And when they see each other in the village, they would say, "How are you, my cousin?" And he go with his Mercedes, and the guy is still. It was very strange. And this guy was a very powerful man, not very powerful, but he was quite rich. And my father tried to be a relative to close to him. That's what I'm telling in the book. He's trying to become somebody.
There are a lot of instances in the books that I would like to talk about, I'm not going to, because there is a surprise within them. I mean, it's not a thing where there's sort of huge drama happening, but there's a way in which we get very sucked into this story of this family, of this young boy who doesn't quite fit in, of his mother, and the father who in some way doesn't totally fit in because he's been away and come back and he has a different set of aspirations. And I wonder whether, because you've written this and published it in the world at a point when these nations of the world are of particular interest to people in a kind of news headline sort of way, do you find a lot of people are trying to read things into your book that maybe you'd prefer? Are they trying to see your book as sort of representative of, in ways that displease you, or do you think actually there's a place for books like these to be part of this conversation of new stories?
It's hard to say, because I think in France something happened with the Arab Spring in the population. For example, one of the most common tourist destinations for French was Tunisia and Egypt during Ben Ali regime and Mubarak regime. And for me, I was always thinking, it's incredible to go to holidays in a country where that are led by dictator like that, and when people, I don't know, they were not interested in politics and things like that. And when they discovered all the revolution and everything, they said, "My God, maybe we don't realize what was happening really in those countries, and we are afraid of it." And what's my book is just the story of my family. It's just a small testimony of what was my life at that time. And I think maybe people want to know how it was for me, for just one family, to find a kind of human trust. I don't know. Mm. It's not a generalization, you know.
At this point, I'm going to open it up for questions. If you could raise your hands, anyone with questions, and wait for the roving mics to come around. And if you could also just say your name and affiliation.
Oh, you're not obligated.
Such a thing, but you don't have to when you do that. So if we could have just hands from anyone, if you could raise hand, anyone with questions. There's always that pause before the first one, and then right when you come to the end and say, we have time for one more, 17 people raise their hands. So get in there early. Right, there's someone. Is there a mic up? Are there mics up there? Oh, yes, there's. Okay. Yeah, there's.
No. Hi. Yeah. Is it what? I'll shut it. Hi, my name is Vincent. I'm a student at LSE. I'm just very interested in. You had an upbringing in France as well as in Syria and Libya. So in France, you have a very strict form of secularism. And in Syria and Libya, you have more of a religious state. So how is that reflected in your cartoons, in your book?
How does it reflect in my book? Actually, I never believed in God. Just my own experience. I tried very much, but it never happened to me. So I speak about that in the books. Nobody told me don't believe in God. Huh? Nobody told me that. Some people told me you have to believe in God, and I tried, but it never happened. So I tell this story.
It's interesting because one thing we hear about the Assad regime is its secularism. I mean, that's one of the things that you know, said, yes, it had its problems, but at least they were secular in this way. But in the book, actually, people are very, I mean, religion plays a very strong role within that. And was that particular to the village or, you know, is this,
no.
Was the idea of the secularism more of a myth?
Yeah, I think, in Syria, your religion was on your ID.
Yeah.
And so everybody had a religion and you didn't have, I don't believe, you know, or I'm an atheist, it doesn't exist. Mm. And one of my cousins one time told me, Riyad, it's better to say you're a Jew than you're an atheist.
Yeah.
It's more bad things to say you don't believe. I totally respect all religion, you know. I would like to believe.
Other questions? There's a woman over there.
Ah, no, you raise hands, huh?
just wait, if you'd wait for the mic, yeah.
Thank you. Did you feel that the events that happened at Charlie Hebdo...
Oh, you're French.
Yeah. did you feel they posed a threat to your professional... I mean, making cartoons and everything?
My position in Charlie Hebdo was very... I was not a cartoonist, for example. Charlie Hebdo was a newspaper where all... The drawers, cartoonists in France, they knew somebody from Charlie Hebdo. They published one drawing inside. And I had a column in Charlie Hebdo called The Secret Life of Youth. And it was a page I sent by mail every day. And it was the only things I saw on the street. For example, two teenagers having an argument or something like that. And I tell it in comic books. I was completely unable to make political drawings about Sarkozy or things like that. You know, I don't like that kind of drawings. It don't make me laugh. I don't know how to. And so on my way of working, nothing really changed for me. But I think it's very difficult for people who make political drawings, yeah. Because especially now in France, when you do, you know, someone with a big nose, for example, celebrity with a big nose, now it's a national disaster, you know. You have half of the population say, it's outrageous, the nose is too big, and the other of population say, no, we have to laugh about everything, and So it's completely crazy. You know, I don't know. I try to not think to those subjects.
There were other hands up there here, gentleman in front.
Hello, my name is Max, and I also start my studies here now at LSE. I was wondering, so if I get you correct, then you try to be not political at all, or do you still try to somewhat influence the what's happening in Syria or in Libya, since you lived there and you grew up there?
I'm not sure I understood your question.
Through your work.
Your English, huh?
through your work, do you try to have like a political influence? In France, in Syria, or in Libya, or do you try to be not political at all?
No, I think every book and everything, is politic, of course. But I don't want how to say my. It's very complicated because I don't have a conviction, political conviction, for example. My main conviction is like everybody on Earth should have, you will see it's very deep, everybody on Earth should have the right to have an open world education, and women and men should be equal everywhere. So this is my main political... But after that, it's very complicated to me to say, oh, this political man is a nice man, this political woman is... I don't want to engage myself, can we say that? That's why I make books. I seek things, you know, logic and illogic, and that's...
I read somewhere you saying that rather than think of yourself as Syrian or Libyan, that actually the, I'm paraphrasing, the tribe you belong to is cartoonists. That those are the people you feel more in common with than anyone on sort of a national basis.
Yeah, because sometimes a lot of people ask me, do you feel more Syrian, do you feel more French? Yeah. So I said I feel more cartoonist, but I must admit, yeah, I don't feel too much cartoonist also. Okay. You know, I don't very like the people who are proud of being cartoonist. You know, it's like a nation.
Right.
We have our own legend, our own history, our own half-gods, you know, in the past. Yeah. And it's quite ridiculous because a lot of cartoonists hate each other and blah, blah, blah. I'm not really fan of the spirit of the football team. Mm. I don't know if, you know, you belong to a team. Yeah, let's go. Mm. We are the small penis man. Yeah, we will go. Yeah. It's, I don't know. Mm. Sorry for this.
There's a question back there.
Hi, my name is Shanji. I'm in LSE. I have a question about languages. So I spent a year in Lebanon, and they speak kind of a mix of French, Arabic, and English. And I was wondering if you think or speak mostly in French and Arabic, only French, or a combination of both, or do you dream in French or Arabic?
I have forgotten the Arabic language completely. I think it's psychiatric. I don't know. It's I know how to write and to do the letters and to read, but the meaning of the words, I know only insults. That's the only strong insults. And it's a shame because I had the opportunity of take Arabic lessons. It was I take Arabic lessons or guitar lessons, and I chose guitar. Now I think I will take Arabic lesson because it's a beautiful language and I want to speak Arabic.
There's some questions up there. There's one at the back there. Do we have a mic upstairs? Sorry. Well, there are quite a few around that area, so why don't we get the mic over that side and...
Hi. My name is Heba, I'm myself Egyptian French. I would like to know what's your opinion about the recent cartoon published by Charlie Hebdo about on the Syrian crisis. Sorry about the accent. Do you think it's really sarcastic or do you think it's more provocative?
Ah, I could answer you if I knew what cartoon do you speak about, because I don't know what it is. I don't read Charlie Hebdo, huh? I left it, huh? I have to tell you, huh?
I'm saying that you're part of it, but because you used to work there, maybe you know about the policy or what they think or
everything. What? It's very, because for example, Charlie Hebdo, if you want to, it's not like it was not like I never went to their meetings. You know, each week they were doing meetings and to say what we are. What will we talk about? I never went to this because they were always having fights and arguments, and they were half of them were drunk, and the other one they were, you know, eating or sleeping because they were drunk the last night. And it was, you know, it was absolutely not like, okay, now we have to speak about that, and everybody, okay, let's do that. Nobody ever asked me, what do you think about this drawing? And nobody told me, your drawing is bad or something. I was sending my drawing to the same guy each week, and he replied me an email saying, thank you. That's it. So that's only, so everybody was responsible of his own production, you know, it's, I know it could be crazy, but it was like that.
There's a question down here.
Hi, I'm George. I'm a big fan of your work and of this city in general. And
thank you.
But and thank you for making me discover Syria and Gates. That's absolutely great. Syria and Gates. I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I like your work also on the that I guess from France, which I discovered in other bits. But because of the LSC, I was there, discovered that you work at Charlie, so I have a Charlie question. Do you think that you can explain Charlie to Anglo-Saxons? I have enormous trouble explaining Charlie Hebdo to Anglo-Saxons. Obviously, I love Cabu and Rolandski, and I was extremely hurt by what happened. But, and then I find myself defending Charlie a lot and being unable to explain to an Anglo-Saxon audience that Charlie means, was there something very specific, very small, and grew out of every proportion.
Yeah.
Can you explain Charlie to is it possible really to explain Charlie? Should it just stay in France, basically? That's my question.
Maybe he should stay in the 70s. Where internet wasn't exist and something like that. I can't explain what it is, really. Also, I experienced it as my own experience was what I told you. You know, it was people having party and have alcohol and drawing a French president and things like that. It was freedom of what they want to say and nobody. It's very. You know, it's very complicated to. I don't know what to say to that. I understand completely that people are offended by. I don't know. I understand also that people love it. I don't know.
There was another question up here before we moved on. Yes.
In the front row. How are you considered in Syria and Libya?
I'm an idol there.
A little blonde idol.
They call me the blonde elf, the legendary blonde elf. And, no, I don't. I think my work is not translated in Arabic. Because I had proposition to translate it in Arabic, but they wanted to translate only the first volume and to see if it works, and then they will translate the rest of the story, and I don't want, because I know it will not work, and I want them to have the whole story. That's.
What about Libyan and Syrian French citizens? I mean, has there been a good response?
People, yeah, I've met a lot of Syrian people who told me that it reminds them memories and things like that, but you must admit, I must admit that people that are able to buy a plane ticket to come in France from Syria are people from the upper class. So they never lived in village like my village, for example. So it's, what can I say? One day it was in Strasbourg. It was during the first, when the first volume goes out, there was a woman in the assistance that was full of gold everywhere. She had gold, and I immediately looked at her and knew she was Syrian. You know, she had white hair like that. She was looking at me like my teacher in school, like, you know, like that. When I was speaking, and at the end of the meeting, when somebody have questions, so they gave her the mic, and she told me, "I want to say something. I haven't read your book, but the way you speak from Syria is not Syria. It's not Syria. No, it's not like that. People, it's like in France. People have cars everywhere. You can go to holiday." And I think she was right in her point of view, because she didn't imagine that in the village 5 kilometers from her house, people were living like in the... It's the same in France. They are part of... in people don't know other people exist, and you know, like, I don't know if you've seen Raymond Depardon movies, for example. He's a French photographer who made movies on the last French peasant that live alone in their farms and lost, and it was very close to what was happening in Syria, and it's still existing in France.
Other questions?
I read both your books, but in the first volume I noticed there were a lot of parts where you included some Arabic, like English, I read the English translation, so there was Arabic sentences and English letters, and I'm sure most people who read your book don't speak Arabic, I think, and I was wondering how important the Arabic is to the story, for people who don't understand it.
It was just for the first volume, because in the first volume I wanted to show how it could be strange to hear a foreign language when you don't know how to speak it. And sometimes the story evolves and there is French and English words in the Arabic, and sometimes at a point everybody speaks Arabic because I understand what everybody is saying. But in the rest of the story, so I was speaking perfectly Arabic, so there will be no more Arabic like that, I think.
Do you ever feel outsider living in France, and the fact that, you know, that you live in three countries and shape you in the way that you, as an artist? How do you look at that, or actually, you know, the way you've done your books, and the same way, do you feel that you actually present the idea from outside of France just because you live in Syria and Libya?
Outsider?
Yes.
How old were you when you moved back to France?
This is a secret. I will tell you in the rest of the... But, I felt not much a part of... Yeah, it's true. I felt like I was different from the other, because of my name, because of my origin. Each time I tried to tell somebody I was from Syria, nobody knew where it was. When I was speaking about Saddam Hussein, for example, to my friends in the college, they didn't know what was happening there. It was so I had this part of my life that I couldn't share with anybody. And because the Arabic-rooted person I've met in France were people from mostly from Algeria or Maghreb, and so they had their own idea on Syrian people. They hated them. I don't know why. You know, Arabs, they had... Moroccan hates Algerian and blah, blah, blah. You don't know why. So it was very difficult to share experience. And also, as my face was not directly Arabic, when I was telling to Arab people that I lived there, and they said, no, you're not Arabic. You're French, 100% French. Mm. So.
Other questions?
Hi, my name is Osin.
So you said a while back that you don't believe in politically engaging, as in political engagement in terms of...
No, for me, only for me. It's my political engagement. I don't believe in my... Because I'm not very brilliant in that field. But
no, because as a cartoonist, your work is supposed is engaging for people, right?
Yeah, of course.
So don't you think like making a statement like that would sort of discredit your work or your ideas on, you know, whatever you showcase? Because it's important to, you know, not devalue the fact that it is political at the end of the day and yeah. It is engaging. But you know, to say something like, "Oh, I'm not." Like if I write something and I would want the world to know the fact that I'm like I stand with what I write, so I would have to engage myself equally. And if I say something just the opposing to what I'm trying to say, I mean write or showcase, it'll just be contradicting my views, and that would sort of discredit my own work. So I mean, are you understand?
No, I don't understand really, but I will try to answer. Because for example. My work had some success in France, so I've met a lot of political people, you know, from left side, right side, far left, etc. And everybody is trying to, you know, tell me, "What do you want? What do you think? Do you want to engage yourself in politics?" And so I think that's, I'm not cool with this idea of engagement, for example, but. For last year, I was nominated in Angoulême. It's an international comics festival, and to be elected to the Great Prize. It's an honor prize, you know, like give a prize for a whole career. And we were 50 names inside this list, this short list, and only men, no women. And when I discovered that I was with 50 men and no women, and because I admire Posy Simmons, I admire Claire Bretécher, I admire a lot of... And I asked myself to be removed from this list, and it was huge in France when it happened, like it was an engagement. And this is the kind of engagement I'm okay with.
So you mean more in terms of conversations, not in terms of... You would step back in terms of political conversations and not.
No, I think I have more leftish sensibilities. I think we should help people who have difficulties in life because my family was really helped, and now I have success. I'm happy to pay taxes and things like that. But I don't know. It's very difficult to. Say, I'm an artist, and now I will give you what I think, and then it's complicated for me. I don't know.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Laurent, and I'm also a huge fan of your work. And in another space of discussion, I wanted to know if the works of Marjane Satrapi, like Persepolis, had an influence of l'Arabe du futur?
Not really, because I started to make comics before she made her first comics. And when she made her first comics, I was thinking, oh, fuck, I will have to wait 10 years before I tell my story. No, because it's you can't come now and do your... but I really, it's a great... work, I know, and Persia is very different world than the village where I was living. You know, so they're not. I don't find common points so much between or experience. That's so. It was not so much an influence.
Hi, I'm Faisal.
Ah, Faisal. Ah,
I can speak loud.
I have 20 cousins called Faisal.
I'm a bit proud of it. I'm a unique person. I'm just curious, because you have a very unique perspective, having grown up under two different examples of a paradigm that's disintegrating right now. And I'm curious if you believe there's hope for Arabia, and if so, where do you think Arabia's hope is? Where does that lie?
Oh, Las Vegas.
It's no question.
Yeah, it's complicated. Yeah. I don't know. I'm a very negative guy, very pessimist. So I think maybe there is hope, but in 500 years, maybe, I don't know. It will take a long, long, long time, I think. I don't know. It's very... When I was young, I think like a lot of you older than you, but when I was young, I was convinced that the future would be... there will be space travel and we will have, I don't know, immortality and things like that. And now, like the main information when I opened the radio is the burkini in France, and it's completely depressing, so I don't know what to tell. I have no... I think it's the rights of women and that must be supported. I don't know. It's a much more important thing.
Why is the title The Arab of the Future?
It's because my father, when I didn't want to go to school, he told me, hey, you have to go to school because the Arab of the future go to school. Because for him, the Arab of the past was, for example, his brothers and sisters who didn't know how to read and to write. And so for him, the future was, you know, Arabic spaceship. Mm-hmm. And Arabic planet with Arabic, like in Star Trek, you know, you have the official Arabic Space Confederation.
Okay, I think we have time for a couple more questions, if there are a couple. There's one at the back there, I think.
Hello. Hi, I'm Dodi. I'm from Greece and Egypt. I haven't read your book, but from listening to you, a lot of the things that you said resonated with me because of the dual nationality. My question comes out of pure curiosity. Do you ever, or have you ever felt shame in maybe creating a piece of a political cartoon only to find out later on that maybe you're misrepresenting something or someone? Or have you always stood firm?
No. I don't regret anything, especially because when I draw my characters in the book, I change all the name and all the faces. I mix faces because people don't know what I have seen. So I protect the real protagonist, you know, sometimes. So nobody can say and tell me, hey, what you draw me with a big nose, huh? The guy who recognized himself as big nose, he said, I draw him a small nose, so he's happy. You know, I mix things, I protect things. I don't want to be aggressive with anybody.
And final question up there. Yeah.
I study politics here at LSE, and one of the things that comes up a lot as an issue when we're talking about nationalism in Europe is rising nationalism, particularly in France. So you talked a bit about how, well, someone asked a question, I think, about how interest in your work has changed due to the Arab Spring, and people are taking more of an interest in areas that they previously couldn't even locate on a map. And I was wondering, first of all, how that affected people's interest in your work, people's responses to your work, but also, have you noticed any changes since France has become more of a focus of terror attacks as well? Or have you noticed much of a difference in people's responses, not just because of the Arab Spring, but also because of growing racism in France?
I don't know. It's very... Maybe what I'm going to say, maybe it's very provocative, but I don't know if it's very difficult for me. I don't see France as a racist country, for example. It's the less racist country I've been to. I don't know. I've been in Japan, for example. It's awful for foreigners. I love Japan, but it's. I've been in the United States. I was in a cab and. The black man told me how hopeful the life of his kid was when he... I don't know, in France, for example, people are interested in others' culture and we have to be proud of this part of the... Of course, there is nationalism and every... But, for example, on the last election, everybody was saying, Marine Le Pen will win, and she didn't win. anything. So France. So now it's you know, presidential election. It's like, oh, Marine Le Pen is coming. It was the same thing 20 years ago. Each time, Marine Le Pen, Jean-Marie Le Pen is coming. And no, I think French are not. It's difficult to speak generally, but the people is not stupid. They don't know how to. They will. They see that Marine Le Pen is crazy. I don't know. Even the much more. I don't believe in that it would be like in Hungary or something like that. I don't think so. French are too open to the world. They are too alcoholic, I don't know. They like to make party and to... No, really, it's difficult for many persons. Maybe they suffer racism when they seek jobs. That's true, because a guy prefer to engage somebody who has a white shirt like me than a guy who... But I don't know if it's not written in the law, and I never had problem to make personally to make studies. For example, I had a bourse, comment on dit une bourse, scholarship from the government, and it was that paid for my. All I had to do, and it's very complicated, I must admit, is to work. So I had to learn and to stay at home and not to. But I don't know. I love France, you know, but I'm not nationalist, you know. That's.
Okay, one plaintive hand and a sort of please me. Okay, one more.
why do you think your work wouldn't be well received in the Arab world? You mentioned you spoke to.
No, not well received. No success, I think. No, because I want my book to be translated in Arabic. But we asked the publisher who was interested, who said, yeah, publish all the books. And he said, no, let's do the first one, we will see. And no, I want the whole story, because in the first one it's quite rough, and the rest of the story there is more, you know, that's... Only that.
All right, well, it remains to me to thank all of you, to thank Riyadh,
thank you.
Particularly. Yes, and a polite reminder to remind me what I'm about to remind you of, which is that the books are for sale outside, and Riyadh will be in here signing books. So please, there are two of them published already. Don't only buy one, because you'll reach the end and you'll feel really annoyed with yourself for not getting the second one. So get both of them. Get them for your family for presents as well.
Thank you.